For June the 17th, 2022, we talk about The Quarry, Citizen Sleeper, and To the Moon. Welcome to Level 418. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm David Meismith.
I'm Jell Apprentice.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. David, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back.
Yeah, what's going on?
Not a whole lot. I'm in hardcore getting ready for Dragon Con season. So doing a lot of costuming work. Mm-hmm. So
nice.
So yeah.
You've got, that's in August, right?
Yeah, technically it's the first week of September.
So. Gotcha. Nice. Can you share your plans for Dragon Con, or are you is that going to be a surprise for your crew?
So let's see. I'm doing a just kind of a cyber goth, type thing. Doing that. I'm doing one of the events they have each year in the costuming track is what they call the bunny hutch, which is basically people dress up as either like cosplay, so either like characters or just kind of weird versions of either Hugh Hefner, the smoking jacket, or not smoking jacket, the robes thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the bunny girl.
Okay.
So I'm doing kind of a cyberpunk take on the bunny outfit.
Cool.
So that'll be interesting. And then probably something with third costume with cat ears and stuff, because Animu.
Of course. It'll fit right in. It's Dragon Con.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what's planned so far. So I've got the bunny outfit, a jacket to make, and then just some miscellaneous, spats and things like that. So
yeah, good on you for like having taught yourself those skills. That doesn't seem easy.
I mean, I have a very good teacher, so.
Oh, okay, yes. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's not like I learned from YouTube. I have a very good teacher, but yeah. No, it's been a lot of fun. The big thing I've been doing new this time is actually drafting some patterns. So, taking existing patterns and combining them, modifying them, tracing them from existing clothing items, stuff like that.
Hmm.
So that's been kind of cool.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I hope your prep for that ends up going well. Jala, how about you? What's going on?
Well, nothing right at the particular moment other than a very annoying tech migration at work, which means like having to go physically into the office and deal with all of my very old coworkers, basically not knowing how to use Teams and having to be explained about literally every last little function. Exciting.
It's not just adapting to a new system. It is helping a number of people adapt to a new system.
Then also those same people just being frustrated because somebody moved their cheese and they don't understand anything. And so having to deal with their disgruntled frustrations and stuff too. It's not like I'm like, okay, some irritating stuff trying to get my work laptop and my home computer all set up on the same deal with a switch in between, just because of like certain plug-in needs and things. But like for them, it's a lot.
Yeah.
So.
I like to imagine when you say you have to, get working with your Switch, you mean like your Nintendo Switch.
When someone makes me responsible for something like that, for their tech problems, right? I never really volunteered to be in that situation. I just would end up in that. Like, and then they express that kind of like, oh, well, it's ridiculous that they're changing it. And, you know, just, it's like, I can't help you. I'm not responsible for it. You, like, I cannot help but feel like that, help but feel like they are blaming me for the problem I am trying to help them solve.
Well, and then too, because I am going to be going out of town. That's my other bit of news. Right. I will be out for several days for the rest of this week. And I had to, in the middle of this tech migration, also get it set up to where everybody has access to each other's emails, because I was like, I cannot leave without you guys being able to actually see my emails and everything, because you're not going to think about it or do it unless you have the easy access already set up for you. Mm-hmm. So I also had to go through all of that. Luckily, the company, the large evil overlord company, which bought my smaller company, is one that is well stocked with IT people who have infinite levels of patience that I cannot even fathom.
Yeah, they're paid to have patience.
My heart goes out to their patience, although I know they are paid probably more than I am. So anyway, my other bit of news is that I'm going to be going to see John, otherwise known as Tethelus in the community, and Desiree. And people may know John from the community, as mentioned previously. You might have seen him on Will's streams. He pops up all the time for those. And other appearances of John in places, and Desiree as well, would be from Monster Dear Monster, where they have both appeared on there to talk about various media, such as Riddick, Ghostbusters, and other stuff. And then also on Jolichon's Place, Des was on with me to talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, DEIB stuff. And John was on this past week discussing the Batman. So everybody would have heard them somewhere else if they've looked. So, nice. But we are going to, Dave and I are going to go visit them. And it will be a very long 12-hour each way drive to go visit them. But we wanted to go do that before stuff in life happened that made it to where we could not do so easily. So.
Nice. Well, I hope you have a good time.
I hope so, too. But I will be playing lots and lots of video games on my Switch while Dave is driving. So,
yeah, 12 hours is a very long time in the car.
Working on your Switch.
Yes. Yeah. No. Well, I guess it is work, kind of, because some of it's assignment play. So,
oh, welcome to the wonderful world of assignment play.
Yeah.
Ben, how about you?
I've been doing pretty good. Had a pretty low-key weekend. I hosted some old coworkers on Saturday for dinner, and then got hosted for dinner on Sunday and played Gaia Project twice. So, nice, relaxing weekend.
Nice. So, yeah. Lots of company, lots of dinners.
Yeah. I had I ate at a new place. There was like a Detroit-style pizza there, and so that was very tasty. I had not had that since Texas, so that was welcome.
No.
So what is Detroit-style pizza? Because I know, according to the internet, Detroit-style pizza is like the mythical form of pizza that no one can decide what it is.
I think, in general, it's just like thicker pan crust. It's supposed to be like the sauce is on top of the cheese and other ingredients. And it's kind of like a dollop instead of like spread over.
Sounds awful.
I've never had it with the with the sauce on top. That sounds more like Chicago style to me. With the sauce on top. David, if you remember from Cincinnati, like Adriatico's would be Detroit style.
Okay.
Yeah, if you get like the Bearcat, like their thick crust kind of thing.
I do miss me some New York style pizza.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you lived in the source, baby, for the real New York slice. Sorry,
I don't want to give Detroit too much credit though, because apparently they claim Coney's as Detroit style hot dogs.
What?
If you look up, I think that's the broader known is like Detroit style hot dog is what a Coney is to the outside world.
No, that can't. Yeah, I'm not even like a Cincinnati chili guy, and I wouldn't even say that Cincinnati gets to lay claim on Coney's. Like that's a like. that just kind of seems like, how dare they?
I could see like Coney as in another name for rabbit. Like I'm pretty sure Detroitians would eat, you know, small rodents out of desperation. But
yeah, people eat rabbit. It's, you know, that's a thing. Oh man. Yeah, no, I miss Adriaticos. Adriaticos was good stuff.
Oh yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
So for the people who are not, I would say from Cincinnati, but this might be specifically from the University of Cincinnati, there was one pizza place that basically all clubs on campus were by convention obligated to have as the pizza that you have at club meetings.
Yeah. Except for Bearcast, except for the college radio station, they did they had Papa John's, and it was just dire times. People would fight over the pepperoncinis, and people would fight over the garlic sauce, and I'm like, what are you doing? Come on. Oh man. Yes, but it is very much the thick crust, the big pepperoni, the kind of spicy sauce. It's good. Now I'm getting hungry, so I'm gonna stop. I don't have too much going on. I'm getting a new roof, which is nice. This is especially apropos because we had a rip-roaring storm last night.
Now, I forget. Last time, I know you're having the roof looked at, but is it a new thing that you're actually getting a new roof?
So very quickly after I had my roof, God, my roof, I say roof because I'm from where I'm from. Very quickly after I had my roof looked at, basically like as they were walking around on it, they said, oh yeah, whoever did this, like the person who flipped my house, used really cheap and thin stuff, like the actual like wood sheeting that makes up the solid part of the roof. You know, like what the shingles are tacked to. Yeah, like it was like bowing in. So yeah, I need to get a new roof because just, you know, for durability reasons more than anything.
Is house flipping ever not awful?
I'm sure there's a way to do it right, but like by, you know, if you're not making a house for yourself to live in and your goal is to make a profit off of it, like with anything related to profit, you're going to cut costs however you can. And my understanding is house flipping is like, what will pass a lazy home inspection?
Yeah, I know. I feel like house flipping and the fact that we have like house flipping TV shows and stuff is just the most late stage capitalism thing ever.
I mean, we've moved beyond it and now we have, you know, massive financial firms owning all kinds of rental units, buying up all of the housing stock in order to rent it at way above cost. It's a real problem. That's an even later stage.
I'm usually the I feel like I'm usually pessimistic, but I feel a little bit more optimistic in this regard where I have one friend from high school who's like a house flipper.
Oh yeah.
It seems like it's more like a bartering system where it's like, okay, I'm going to do this molding because then the house will cost like $2,000 extra, or I'm going to do this type of flooring because then I can charge like $4,000 extra.
Yeah.
But I guess I didn't interpret it as much of being like, what can I like not fix? Or like, how can I like screw the
rules?
I
just interpret it as like, what can I add to maximally make sure that poor people can't afford this house?
I don't know. I'm speaking about like an industry, quote unquote, that I don't know an awful lot about. It's just when I think about the incentives, it is how can I make the house seem expensive and get a lot of money without actually putting a whole lot of money into it.
Yeah, I think it depends on like who's flipping it. I think if it's like a giant company doing like house flipping, then yeah, I could totally see that. I think if it's like an individual and they have like a business around it, then
yeah,
they probably have a counter incentive to like have like a good reputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I'm not saying anything against people who do it. I'm just saying more the fact that I don't know it, the that like the popular TV shows and side hustle is like, you know, Pimp My Ride, except for things most people, you know, need but can't afford.
Yeah.
Guys, how did we get to house flipping?
Because I mentioned the person who flipped my house didn't do a very good job with the roof. And so I need to pay thousands of dollars to get a new one. We had a terrible storm last night. Like, power went out. Power is still out in a bunch of the town. Internet's still out in a bunch of the town. I'm fine. We lost power for like 5 minutes. Just all kinds of tree limbs are down. And like, I saw a tree that was ripped in half, like in the center of town here. When I was out doing an errand earlier. Yeah, it was rough stuff. Probably, you know, nothing like, you know, Jolla lives in actual hurricane zone. But like here we get really bad thunderstorms and, it's rough. Hmm. It was a big one. Cats got scared. Yeah, they're fine though.
Yeah, little animals do not like the loud booms.
Yeah,
it's still. This is probably a dumb thing. It's still strange to me that animals haven't evolved just being chill about storms. Like, obviously, get undercover, but I feel like, you know, this is something that kind of happens.
Yeah, don't know. It's and evolution versus also like they're relatively uncommon. Like you're gonna hear a storm and it's gonna be your first storm. You know,
sure.
Like Dottie, you know, she's barely 2 years old. She has probably heard fewer than like five big storms, like really big point. Storms. Yeah, that and they're not very smart. So, Well, that is a whole bunch of banter. I think we ought to get into, the regular kind of show. What would the grind, the multiplayer, and the end boss? And we can get started with...
The Grind.
The Grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the past period of time or so. David, you've been away the longest, so I will throw it to you.
Sweet. So, let's see. I'm trying to think, you know, what have I played that's new since last time? So, I'm continuing on with the, Destiny 2, just kind of grinding through that process.
Okay. It
continues to be a very weird experience in that I really like Destiny. I despise the way they have made it a game as a service.
Didn't it start as one, or?
No, not really. I mean, I suppose technically, but it started out with like, I don't know, you have like a handful of missions each day that you can complete in, you know, maybe an hour or two.
Okay.
And that's basically it. And if you don't complete them in a given day, it doesn't really matter, you know, all you're out is just strictly the time you didn't spend, you know, leveling or, you know, searching for loot. Whereas now they've added, you know, a battle pass, seasonal story content, and then a bunch of, you know, various events. So there's just one of the big things they added is on launch, none of the equipment was randomized. So if you got a certain weapon, you know, that you now had that weapon, you know, you'd get other copies, but, you know, you just sold them or whatever because they're all the same.
Yeah.
Now they've added in the, you know, the seeking after quote unquote God roles for a given weapon. Mm. And likewise, all of the armor can have stats that are basically between like, I don't know, maybe 45 and I think 67 points total across the various stats. And so the number of stat points on given armor are random, as is the distribution.
Okay.
I think what makes it really bad, though, and really frustrating, is the fact that all of that effort is completely outside of the actual raw getting more powerful kind of leveling up mechanic.
Okay.
So you have what's called a light rating. So each piece of armor has a light rating. And I think it currently goes up to like 1,570, something like that.
Jesus. It was like 20 when the game first came out, I feel like.
It was like alternate advancement kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so then, and your overall light rating is, I think it's the average of all of the equipment slots you have. So, but where that comes from is, or where that makes it annoying is, until you reach that maximum light level, all of the equipment you're getting, you can basically consume a piece of equipment to make another piece of equipment get that equipment's light level. So it's not wasted, but it's a thing where basically you're constantly replacing equipment as you're getting new light levels until you reach the cap. But the thing that's frustrating is the equipment is set up where this isn't unique equipment. It's just hundreds of copies of the same equipment. And so you can't... Basically, I guess what I'm getting at is the fun of the game is built around, you know, trying to get either the perfect combination of stats or the combination of stats that fits your playstyle, but that doesn't really work that well until you get to the level cap.
This sounds like a combination of like, what if we combined progressing up the ladder in Amway with like redeeming credit card frequent flyer miles?
Yeah, it is not great.
Like,
and the thing that's frustrating is, you know, all this bad stuff is tied to a lot of good stuff. Right. You know, the seasonal story elements, you know, are, you know, generally have, you know, are, you know, full new, you know, new story, have a couple of cutscenes and are fully voiced. And, you know, at least so far, the, you know, two I've experienced so far are actually legitimately, you know, interesting stories that have, you know, character development and stuff like that. So it's like, there's good stuff there. It's just tied to this weird system of like, we also want to make sure you play 5 hours every day.
It just sounds bloated. It sounds bloated to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Huh.
So yeah. Yeah. So there's, I don't know, there's a lot of problems, with it. On the plus side, I have been getting some of the more interesting weapons now, and there are some really interesting weapon and armor designs in this game. I think my favorite is, about a season ago, they introduced weapon crafting.
Okay.
And there's this alien artifact that, I don't know, it's unclear. Like, a lot of the current storyline is, at least to a certain degree, built around figuring out exactly what's going on with it.
All right.
But there's, you know, an armor set with it that's kind of themed around this, and it's really interesting because it's sort of like all of the armor looks like, you know, those pictures where you take a AI and tell it to make a picture of something, mm-hmm. and it's in the vaguely right shape, but it's also matched together like the thing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All of the all of these weapons are sort of like if you did that, but trained the AI on like hardware and guns and things like that. So, you know, they're recognizably guns, but they'll also have like buttons sticking out of it and stuff like that. And it's designed in a way, it's very obviously, it's not just like the sci-fi, like, oh, we need to add some extra buttons. It's very clearly like, oh, this was designed by something that didn't know what a button was, but had tried to intuit that buttons are important to technology, so let's stick some on.
They are correct. Buttons are very good and important.
Integral. Can't finish a podcast without them.
No.
I shake my head at you. And then this season is all about the kind of Lovecraftian horror, skeleton things. So all of the equipment from this season is basically skeletal guns with, you know, that kind of aesthetic and horror that they'll really, really overemphasize, like the lens flare and stuff like that, to give everything almost the look of like an astigmatism type thing. You know what I mean? That kind of look.
Oh, are you talking like a chromatic aberration kind of thing?
Yeah.
Where like the colors are kind of separated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like with this, to kind of give that feeling, all of like the red dot sights and stuff like that from this season are, you know, have that weird chromatic aberration, that sort of thing.
Huh.
So it's very, very evocative. Very cool.
Hmm.
So yeah, a very good game with very bad live service.
Yeah.
Functionality.
Huh. Well, that's a shame.
So, on the other hand, a game that has very good live service functionality is No Man's Sky, which started a new season or a new expedition, they call it, called the Leviathan, which the big thing here is this is a roguelike expedition.
Okay.
So every time you die, you have to start over. But then with that, it's built around the challenges you have to complete to complete the expedition. A lot of them are fairly easy, or not exactly easy, but you know, in the spirit of like a roguelike, they're things you can, you know, do repeatedly on a run and kind of optimize for.
Okay.
And then they give you very, very, you know, much more powerful rewards than normal. On the other hand, the catch is that the rewards are very random. So, for example, a lot of them will unlock, say, one of the weapons for you, but which one they unlock is completely random.
Hmm.
So they also then have, as there's objectives that as the community completes, it basically makes the rewards you get from these challenges more powerful. So to kind of have, you know, a sort of a meta progression.
Okay.
In terms of storyline, I'm apparently chasing a Leviathan that is a giant space whale.
That lines up.
Yeah, that's all I know so far. But you know, space whales, not the weirdest thing in No Man's Sky.
Yeah, you
No Man's Sky, it's Whale Sky.
you traditionally don't enjoy rogue. Traditionally, in the past, you have expressed a displeasure for the roguelike loop. You know, of losing stuff. How does this kind of get around that for you?
Partially, it's a fairly slow paced game. And so I've only died. So one of the challenges, one of the initial challenges is to die and like restart. And so I died then, and then I died. This is playing survival rule set, which is kind of the more difficult version. And I don't normally play on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize it dramatically increases fall damage. And so I had one death where basically a fall that normally, you know, would maybe cause a little bit of shield damage instead instantly killed me.
Right.
So basically, one, you as long as you put in the effort to manage your risk, you can get around that.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It is a game where you can really, most danger you decide if you're going to get into it.
Right, exactly. And there are some workarounds. It does not wipe your bases. So if you basically build a base on each of the main checkpoints, then once you die, you can fairly quickly jump back in and kind of get those, get back to where you were.
Yeah.
Also, it does help that dying and being reborn is a important theme in the story, even outside of this mode.
Right.
So it does at least kind of, fit with the, kind of the meta, whatever they have.
Yeah, if it fits under the game's schema for the way it,
right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. There are some downsides. I personally think the survival mode actually is, in a lot of ways, not a great mode overall. In that a lot of the difficulty is just significantly decreasing how many resources you mine and then increasing what things cost. So in my opinion, a lot of it ends up just being more grindy as opposed to more difficult. However, I think this was probably very much a thing where, this is kind of an experiment, and I'm guessing in future expeditions we'll see the same thing, but with more bespoke features.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I mean, it's good to see them still experimenting 6 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, I do not understand the economics of that, but I'm glad it works for them.
It consistently features on best-selling lists on at least PC, marketplaces. So
yeah, I'm surprised. I would have thought eventually they would have run out of people to sell to, but clearly they have not.
Also, releasing it on different platforms too gets new. They just open themselves up to new markets. Yeah.
So other than that, I was inspired by Dennis to pick up SnowRunner. Did he talk about that on last week's show?
Yes, he did. And if I was not so busy playing Vampyr, I would be disappeared in that. There wouldn't even be a show.
yeah, it's surprising. I've always wondered, one of the things I've always wanted to try is what would games that work for me that I like but that are non-violent look like? And I think this is definitely a example of one. I think part of it is there's sort of a strategy, almost dungeon crawling aspect to it, because a lot of it is about plotting out how you're going to get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. Also there is a, progression system, which I really like. Other than that, I don't know that I have a lot of, super insightful whatever to it. I do kind of like the inadvertent, implication of the setting that, this is, it almost has a, Death Stranding type of feel of this is a world where apparently just nothing works right. And just, every road you get to, it's like, oh, we had a rock slide,
Yeah.
Can you clear it for us? It's like, how do you people get anything done?
I mean, Death Stranding does make sense as a comparison based on what I've heard. Another thing that makes me intrigued about it, just because it does sound like it is just about thinking about movement in a video game in a very different and more granular way that is not straight up getting over it with Benefati or Quap kind of deal.
Yeah. I think the winch is actually a surprisingly compelling mechanic, because there's a big element of the strategy is, you know, figuring out, you know, when you're tackling an obstacle, thinking through, like, can I do this without ever getting so far from a tree that I can't, you know, pull myself if I need to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, similarly, you know, if you use intelligently, there's a lot of shenanigans you can do with, you know, like if you can't, if you have, say, a tractor trailer or whatever, that you can't get through some, you know, deep mud. If you, you know, detach the trailer, drive a bit away, and then winch it, you can sometimes, you know, pull it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's also kind of fun. It seems like they do a fairly aggressive job of, you know, trying to model all the various off-roady bits, you know, limited slip differentials and I don't know, top heaviness. I know very little about off-roading, but it seems very cool. So far I've mainly been running around Michigan. I just dipped into Russia a little bit recently because that lets you get a whole bunch of weird Warsaw Pack vehicles.
Okay.
But I don't know. Russia is apparently made solely of mud. So, you know, so far things have not been going real well with that. But, yeah. You know, we'll see.
Nice.
That's all I got.
Cool. Ben, I know that you've got one. You've got a new one. What, how about you?
So I got two, and I think we'll end with like a segue. So the first one I got is Citizen Sleeper, which came out maybe a month or two ago.
Oh, that looks amazing.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it on the podcast. We did a news story about it at one point in time.
It was announced at like a PC game show. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, that game's going to be awesome when it comes out. And I'm happy to hear that it is.
Yeah. So for people who don't remember, it's kind of similar to like a space science fiction-y like D&D type game.
Mm-hmm.
You play as a robot who's escaping a kind of evil corporation, and you've kind of landed on this space station that's like a city that's like revolving around kind of like a 2001 type spaceship situation. But it's an entire city on it. And the gameplay of it is every day you're given a certain number of die that are randomly rolled, like 1 to 6. And you use those die to do different actions on the city. Basically, there's just a bunch of nodes on the city. And you do it to do like odd jobs to make money or to further relationships with certain people who are on the space station. And they have like a simple system for it where it's like if you use a higher number, you have a higher probability of success. So if you use like a 6 to do an action, you have like 100% success rate. If you use a 1 to do an action, you have like a 50% neutral or a 50% fail rate. And those are the only three outcomes. It's like success, failure, or neutral. And it scales up between the 1 and the 6. So it has this like weird, like kind of board game type mechanic to it where you're trying to manage like what actions you want to do and like which ones to prioritize. But then on top of that, they have this like very like D&D-esque system where it's like they have really good like characters and really good writing and basically a whole bunch of like side quests that you can do throughout the game.
Mm-hmm.
So what to say about it besides that? It's maybe like a 8 to 12 hour game, maybe somewhere in that region. I guess I don't want to spoil too much about it, so I won't talk about like end game or anything like that as far as like narrative goes and stuff. The one thing I will say is the number of dice you get, I mentioned before, it's kind of variable. It's based on, you have two health bars, essentially. You have like an energy system and you have like your actual health system. Mm-hmm. And both of those decrease every day. And they kind of, the relationship between them is if your energy is completely at zero, then your health will decrease faster each new day. And so the first part of the game is trying to kind of like stabilize this and figure out how you can stop decreasing health. Like mm-hmm. the narrative reason for it is like you're a robot that's owned by a corporation. And it's kind of like a Blade Runner where it's like you're not supposed to exist outside of the realm of the corporation. So there's like things in place for you to just naturally like die if you're away from it. So the first part of the game is just trying to stabilize and like kind of build up a way that you like stop dying. And then after that, it becomes more like you're kind of in control and you can kind of pick where you want to go and who you want to do missions for. They have like an RPG element over it as well, where you have like six different attributes. And they're kind of like generic things like strength, endurance, interfacing for like computers, that sort of thing. And it's a pretty simple level up system. You at worst, you have like a negative one in that ability. And at best, you have a positive two at that ability. And that affects die rolls or die values in any action that's related to those sorts of things. Hmm. So like, say you want to go to a shipping area of the space station and just like move crates all day or something. That might be a strength task. And so based on what your level is on that, you could, if you played like a four die roll and you were like maxed out level, you get like plus two to six and it'd be guaranteed success. So that's kind of like the RPG end of it. So you can specialize in certain things. Like say you want to go really hard in like interfacing with computers, you can do that. On top of just having die modifiers, there's like a perk system embedded in it. So it's like plus attribute, get a perk, plus attribute, get a perk sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And those are different for each one. And they kind of have these sort of random game effects where it's like you get twice as much if you do this thing or whatever. The RPG part and like the economy is like is really well done for the first half of the game, because there's a lot of kind of opposing forces at the beginning of the game that you kind of have to overcome and work around. One minor like criticism of the game is towards the latter half of the game, economy just stops being a problem completely. You kind of make like infinite money. And so then at that point, it's kind of about playing out the narratives that you want to see the ends of. And then you can kind of check those out. I think the one thing I didn't mention about the task is basically you're filling up a meter whenever you do a task. So it's kind of like it looks like a circle that's like cut into different pie slices. Mm-hmm. So it might have like eight or four or six or something. And a success will be like fill up two slices or fill up three slices, something like that. So there's certain tasks that'll be like very long task. It might be like 16 wedges you need to fill up and you're only getting like two at a time. So you also have to kind of prioritize like what long-term goals you want to go for versus what short-term ones you want to do. So I can give us kind of like my final thoughts of the game, or if you guys have any questions about the game, I can answer any. Or
so can you fail and like die or whatever?
I never got to that point. I assume that there's a fail condition, and I assume that you can die since you have like a health meter. But then what's interesting is I only did the one playthrough, so I only played the game and beat it once. There are certain perks where it seems like you could try and do alternate methods. So I tried to keep my health like four to five, or I think like five to six at any given time. I can't remember if you get six die or five die is the maximum number. It might be five. So I always tried to stay within like zero to one of the maximum number you could get and tried to finagle that. And I was able to do that for the most part, but there's certain perks where it's like, you can have like zero health and you always get a guaranteed like two die or something like that. You might be able to have like alternative routes where you're kind of making more risky decisions. The time element of the game, there's certain things require you to do things in a certain amount of time, but by and large there's not really a tight constraint on like you need to beat the game in 50 days versus 100 days versus 200 days, something like that. And that was something else that I was a little bit surprised by, is I thought there would be some sort of I guess reward for doing things more quickly, but that never kind of came out. So in general, I think this is like there's really good gameplay mechanics kind of embedded in this game. I think if they make a sequel, I'd be very interested in playing that, because there's like a few things that still need to be like hashed out. But if you're just in it for like the narrative, then I think this game is like, you could easily recommend this game to play. The narrative is like pretty strong. All the characters are really differentiated from one another, and like the writing is really good. So like, I very big thumbs up on that. A minor criticism is it's like, it's so good to the point where, like, you know, I call in a Christopher Nolan movie, how all the characters are very smart and like, there's no differentiation there. Like they're all equally witty and all equally intelligent, you know, there's no dumb characters. All the characters in this game are like that for charisma, you know, it's like everybody, you know, knows exactly what their role is and they like do it to a T, you know? And so it's like, so sometimes like the, you know, like everybody, you know, like being kind of full of themselves gets like, you're like, all right, I get it. But, but in general, the writing is really, really good. I think this is a game that does like a lot with a little, cause like in general, there's just like the one map of the space station that has a bunch of nodes on it. And then there's, you know, the characters you see when you click on them and the writing and stuff. And so it's not like a overly complicated game, but it, there's a lot that stimulates the imagination when you play it. So,
I mean, so it's relatively short. Does it seem like the kind of game where you're making enough choices that it would make sense to go back in and try a different tack, or is it more, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was like another minor criticism too, is, and something else that kind of would need to be like fixed with like balancing with the end game issue, is by the end of the game, you've kind of upgraded every stat to its maximum value. And I think, there was only one stat of the six that I hadn't maxed out, but it was like maybe the second or third highest that it could be. So by the end of the game, you can do everything. And so it's not, and then this is kind of ties into the problem where it's like, you can just make infinite money and it's not a big deal. It would be nicer if there was more like differentiation in the balancing where it's like, okay, you can only fully specify in like one or two stats, and yeah, there's replayability. Like you would need to go back and like try again if you wanted to focus on this sort of thing. Yeah. And the game is short enough that you could totally warrant doing that. Like it's, you know, it's like a 6 to 10 hour game, maybe. Mm-hmm. I played it and beat it in 2 days, I think.
Yeah.
See, that's actually why the corporation was trying to keep you from escaping. You escape and you break the economy.
Yeah. It's a really cool system. Like the economy is really interesting in the game, where it's like, you know, for example, there's a restaurant where you pay a certain amount of credits and it gives you food, which translates to like energy. But there's like a place where you know, like there's like scrap metal you can get, and there's a place where you can like use scrap metal to either sell for money, but then later you can use it to sell for energy and stuff and like that. There's like a bunch of nodes to kind of do all this like economy translation. And so that part's really interesting, and like discovering like the city and figuring out how all that stuff interacts and like kind of where to focus on. All that's pretty interesting. And they even do a good job of having different nodes that, instead of it being like the 1 through 6, like 6 being good, 1 being bad sort of thing, there's a couple of ones where it's like you specifically need a 1 die roll if you want to do this action, or you specifically need a 2 die roll if you want to do this sort of action. And that further makes the interesting strategy as far as like, okay, these are the 5 numbers I have. I can do this one on this action, and I'll save these other 3s for this. You know, maybe I'll get a failure there, so I'll have to like reserve 3 die for it, something like that. And then the order you do them, the gameplay part is, I thought, was really interesting as well. So,
mm-hmm. So is any of this voice acted or anything like that?
maybe this says something about how I play games, but it's like I can't remember. I think most of it is read. I think in fact all of it is read.
Yeah,
I believe. Okay. I believe that's the case for this game, but I would have to go back and check to see if that's the case. But I'm pretty sure it is. So yeah, that could be an area of improvement too. Is maybe going the Disco Elysium path, is like adding some voice at first, and then if people really like the game, adding full voice or something. But yeah. I think, Cole, I texted you about it because I recommended it to you, because this would be a perfect game, I think, for like, since I feel like you do a good job of reading any game that you're playing anyway, this would like, it would be right up your alley.
Yeah.
So I know something I really like about this game, and this is, I don't know, maybe a kind of a weird side thing, but the fashion for the characters is really compelling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, all the different characters, you know, clothing and stuff like that is very impactful. I'm actually looking at maybe buying the art book, even though I don't actually own the game, because I'm actually wanting to do some cosplay based on some of this stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, I would say, yeah, most of all the costumes are very like vibrant and kind of like steampunky, I guess, but space punky, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Looks it's kind of in the same zip code as Transistor, it appears.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, just the idea of an 8-hour game. I'll rub my hands together like, an 8-hour game.
If you got like a D&D itch, man, this definitely scratches it. So, yeah. So I'd be curious too, because like, I'd be curious to see like somebody who's like really into D&D but not as much into game mechanics would be how they would like this game. If like the game mechanics get in the way, or if they're too hard or too easy, or what. So, yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So I think that's all I got to say about it. Any other questions about that one?
Not for me. Everything I would ask is a spoiler. So,
all right. The second game I got, I think I can segue into Jala because I have been playing The Quarry.
Ooh,
which I think Jala as well.
I played the first 50 minutes of The Quarry today.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. All right. I
heard The Quarry. I thought maybe you're doing some like database work.
Yeah, I also heard The Quarry. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it a quarry? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah. When it's a when it's a big pit where you pull rocks from, it's the quarry. And also, you know, like the quarry is like something you hunt for. You know,
when it's
like,
a big pit, you pull data from. It's a quarry. Mm-hmm.
So this is the game that's kind of like the spiritual sequel to Until Dawn. I guess that company's made a bunch of games in between then with the anthology series they had, but I think this game has the same game director as the Until Dawn game.
Yeah.
And then thematically, it's also very similar to, it feels like a 80s like summer camp horror flick.
Yeah. Big Friday the 13th vibes. Yeah.
Yeah. And the main cast of characters are kind of like young, dumb teenagers, very similar to Until Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know how we want to do this since three of us have played this game.
So I haven't played very much of it. I literally just got a chance to do the like the opening, like right up until the first kills, let's say.
Okay.
You know, just very, very, very firmly the prologue. I would have been remiss if I didn't bring something new, and I just picked it up. I had picked it up, and then I had to beat Vampire okay. over the weekend. So
okay,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can go ahead and talk all about it, Ben, to the extent you will, and I will talk about it in more general terms. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. I'll. Jill, how far have you played in it?
I've played a couple of hours into it, but I'm going to be streaming it. But by the time this episode comes out, I will have already streamed it, mm-hmm. but I'm going to be streaming a fresh game.
Okay. Right. Sweet. So. Okay. Well, yeah, I'll speak in generalities then and not spoil anything since mm-hmm. you guys have it coming down the pike. Yeah. So I guess in general, I enjoy this game. I guess like, it feels very much in the same vein as Until Dawn. The characters, you hate the choices that they make, but that's very much what happens in a horror movie where you're like, oh man, they're so dumb. Why are you doing this? But you control some of them. So some of them you can take authority over. So I played through this game twice. I think it's a little bit shorter than Until Dawn. I did a regular playthrough, like how I wanted to play it. And then just yesterday I did a second playthrough where I just wanted like a Nimrod playthrough where like everybody's very short and mean to one another. And everybody's very like selfish and just do like self-saving actions the entire time. And so it's a lot quicker because I just ignored like all the things that are in the environment and then people start dying. And so then the game goes a lot quicker that way. but so I kind of got to see like both sides of it as far as like how far, things extend, you know, or how much you're kind of on a rail and like tunnel down the same decision. So one thing I was happy to see in this game is it does feel like there's more respect for your choices that you make, as far as like giving you unique scenes and unique dialogue based on like what sort of thing you choose. And I think that's maybe part of why it's a shorter game compared to Until Dawn, is, you know, they have to like respect all these different choices.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a little bit wider in a sense. But that's, I mean, that's not to say that the game isn't like on rails to some extent, because it's, you know, even if you're make the happiest of happiest choices and the like meanest of like violent choices, you still kind of like go to the same places. And there's not much differentiation until like the last few chapters, essentially. But that's kind of on par for these types of games. I don't know. So the prologue focuses on two characters, kind of sets the stage for the setting of the game, which is at like a camp, a summer camp. After the prologue, that you have seven main characters in the game that are all like the camp counselors of the area. So they're all like teenage, college age type or whatever. And yeah, it plays out very, very similar to Until Dawn. There's a really good kind of like horror narrative to the game, that's very like R.L. Stine-y, I guess, where there's like a lot of intrigue on like what's happening and why. There's a lot of like pairing off of characters where it's like, oh, these two go over here, these three go over here, that sort of thing.
Well, like, if you split up, you cover more ground.
Yeah, I know. It's such a smart decision. So, but it's also good too, because it like kind of like helps develop the characters and the relationships among them, and all that stuff is pretty well done. You know, there's different characters like have relationships or romantic interests with one another's, and different characters like hate one another. And so like managing all that's like interesting and fun. And it gives you like enough choices of like, fun ways to interact with one another, whether you can be like short or nice to one another. I don't know. What did you guys think of the game so far?
I'll let you go, Jill.
Well, okay. So I'm going to talk about kind of the series of games overall, because I finally put my finger on the thing that was bothering me about Until Dawn and The Quarry and the other entries in this series. So when you were playing Until Dawn on Hex Crank, Cole, I could not stand to watch you play for very long.
Okay.
And at the time, I chalked it up to, I hate these characters, and I left it at that. And that's what I told everybody. I was like, I can't stand them. And everybody's like, well, yeah, but they're going to die. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to have to sit here and wait for to get to that part, you know?
Yeah, they're going to die, but at what cost?
Yeah. Well, so later on, I popped in when you were doing, I think it was House of Ashes that you were doing?
Yes.
Yes. And so I was able to hang out for that one for the most part. But this past weekend, my friend Moogie started streaming multiple playthroughs of The Quarry, and that prompted me to buy the game, actually, because I was talking about it with Dave, and I finally put my finger on what it is that was bothering me about these.
Okay.
So the reason for my discomfort with all of these stems from my experiences as a smaller-sized female person of color.
Okay.
The people in Until Dawn and in The Quarry are all white kids and some people of color, but they speak and act like the white kids.
Okay.
And they're all coded like frat boys and girls, which are absolutely red flag danger zone types for someone like me in actual ass life. So in my experiences, that's never good stuff. So okay. While in slasher movies, like if I'm watching Scream or Friday the 13th or whatever, I'm not triggered with any kind of anxiety or anything because they're passive experiences, because these are a series of video games wherein I am forced to engage with these danger zone characters and be in this situation, if you will, and
right.
Make choices. And some of those choices are like, go along with it or go along grudgingly. I'm like,
right.
You're still making me do the thing that I don't want to do, and I would be nowhere near these people in real life. So, you know, it causes all kinds of anxiety and dread, cold pit in the stomach type feelings, because that's just like, that's setting me personally up for harm, in actual life if I were in around these types of people. So that's what caused that. And I finally figured that out. The interesting thing is that, as I mentioned, these feelings still remain even if I'm watching somebody else, such as you, stream them, because those choices are still presented and they're still being made by somebody, and I just get anxious about it. And I didn't have these feelings when watching you play House of Ashes, because the characters in that one are military people. And even though I was married to a submariner in the Navy at one point in time, I did not live on base. So the degree to which those danger zone types affected me in real life was way less. So I didn't have a problem. But that game, Dave cannot play because he was in the military and he had to deal with those. And so he actually talked when we were talking about it, he was like, I can't play that one because it's just, it's too much. It's too much for me. So the Quarry does have a movie mode, but all it does is eliminate button mashing QTEs and like aiming shooting segments, but it still leaves the choices in there. So you still have to make the choices. So that doesn't make a difference for me in the experience of the game.
Yeah. So what brought you around to deciding to stream it?
That was exactly the next thing I was going to talk about, because since I've put my finger on what the problem is, so to say, and what the actual horror of this game is for me, which is actually the playing of the game, that's the part that causes dread for me. It's not the actual things happening on the screen. Anyway, I want to see how things pan out as I can play it myself, armed with this knowledge, and like, being cognizant of it allows you to kind of take a step back from it. Having those words and having that verbalized makes, you know, frames it in a certain way. So I will be playing it. And also there will be a point. I anticipate that there is going to be a point in the game wherein eventually either the people who are the most egregious die because I will intentionally hate them and make it to where they die, or because like the situation gets dire enough that they stop acting like, you know, terrible people. Those things will occur at some point, and then from there I can kind of go on.
Yeah.
So you guys probably actually all much more knowledgeable of like horror movies, stuff like that, because that's than me, because that's definitely not my genre. But my understanding is that sort of, I guess, casting, for it, lack of a better word, it, from things I've read, is probably very intentional, right? Because that's kind of the is that a thing?
I mean, well, I'll let you go.
Yeah, it's like, these character types are lifted from like tropes of the medium of horror movies, and specifically slasher flicks. But
because like I've never seen a slasher movie, so
well, the thing is that I've seen slasher movies, and I don't have any problem watching a slasher movie. But then again, it's not putting me in the shoes of being there and controlling the characters to project myself into it. This is making me project myself into it, and that's where the kind of stigma comes from.
Yeah.
I did want to mention, too, that Dave, Cameron, Leonard, and I will be discussing our experiences overarchingly with the entire Until Dawn Dark Pictures Anthology series, and how they function for us on Monster Dear Monster sometime next month in July. So if hearing different viewpoints of a diverse cast of hosts sounds good to you, then we will be having a variety of different individuals with a lot of different experiences. Cool. We all come from very, very different backgrounds.
I'll be curious to see how your experiment in streaming it will work, because you know, I don't have that same experience, but in the past, for me, being able to name a problem has given me a little bit more power over it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And also, if you decide it's not for you, it's not for you. But I think it's kind of important, because you're not the only person who feels this way, obviously.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And it surprised me when I was talking to Dave, and Dave said, you know, yes, the same thing, but only with this one particular one because of the military aspect. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting, because that's the one that I can see and not have a problem with.
Yeah. No.
So anyway, what were your thoughts about it, Cole?
So obviously I'm very short, you know, only very shortly in. So I haven't even had all of the mechanics laid out for me, according to the tutorials. Man, I love the tutorial videos. Those little like cartoon animation kind of deals. Yeah, it's pretty Fallout-esque, but they're very well done. I think just like generally, this feels. So I don't know what y'all are playing it on. Ben, I assume PS5. Mm-hmm. Jala, are you playing it on PS5 or is this a PC for you?
PC.
PC, okay. I'm playing it on PS5 and I'm playing it on my nice TV. Wow, this game looks amazing. Holy crap, does it look good? I don't know if there's ray tracing going on, but like having just recently played, you know, the PS4 version of Until Dawn, you know, a game that I thought looked really good when I first streamed it like a year or so after it came out, that game is showing, you know, it's kind of long in the tooth visually, going kind of right to this, even from, House of Ashes, which is a game that was made for the PS4 and Xbox One, you know, kind of generation of systems. Wow. This is an incredibly good looking game.
I will interrupt to say that I had the weirdest super freak out about it when the people are talking, just because of the weird rubber face uncanny valley stuff like that. That freaks me out. But yes, otherwise it is very nice.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where like it'll be a very long time before we solve that problem, if we ever do the uncanny valley kind of stuff. But like there are, you know, like little like it inches forward in certain ways. So like the thing that I noticed was like, not just that they're modeling how camera lenses would like show, you know, would show a person, you know, in this light, you know, like it does a really good job of doing like low light pictures of faces and stuff like that. But like, I noticed like the sclera of individual characters' eyes, you could see, you could see the veins on them, you know, and they were like, and they weren't uniformly colored. Like you could see through people's skin to their blood vessels, you know, behind it. Obviously this is like technical, like flashbang wizardry, you know, but how much that matters is up for debate. Like obviously that can be kind of like drinking salt water. You pursue that photorealism kind of at your own peril. However, I would say, and have for a while, that visual fidelity really helps horror, specifically because it lets you, you know, show more convincing scenes and draw you into it, right? If this is going to be a lean forward version of the medium, it is, you know, you can only benefit from making the scene kind of more convincing to draw you in. So like that is the thing from my 50 minutes of playing it that really sticks out for me. Otherwise, like, you know, I have a couple of thoughts about what might be going on. You know, they are, you know, doing red herrings on this, obviously, but like, I don't know. I can kind of just take one of these, like a game of this scale and this type, you know, every few years with maybe some of the Dark Pictures anthology in the middle to tide you over. you know, this is just it is a neat kind of game. And like outside of, you know, like doing Life is Strange stuff, I feel like Supermassive has really, from just an overall experience standpoint, you know, questions about the characters and the situations they put you in, that you're raising, Jala, you know, putting aside temporarily, but just the experience, Supermassive has probably done the best in the business at making these a delight to play. So like, I am very excited to dig into this more. Because this first 50 minutes has been good.
Yeah, I think I agree with both your points where the graphics seem good. And yeah, I think I also noticed the places where the people's faces seemed weird when they were talking and just kind of have to overlook those. I think there's like a lot of, it's a very like rickety game and very like loosely like tied together, because there's plenty of like transition points in the game that are like, you know, awkward or something, or it's like you say something really mean and then you get to the like join back scene and everyone's happy again or something like that. But overall, the, you know, like, it feels like you're reading like an R.L. Stein book is kind of like how it feels for me playing it. And yeah.
Cole, do you think it's going to be cryptids again this time?
I have no idea. I mean, this is literally something that happens in the first like 10 minutes, but there's stuff from a like a circus sideshow. But like, who knows what's going on? But there's also other like horror trope stuff. There's a weird cop who features very very prominently in the opening, which is pretty. I mean, they do a good job of making him feel I want him away from me.
Yep.
That's Sam Raimi's brother, by the way.
Oh, okay. I saw a Raimi in the credits. Weird. It's been a long time since I thought of David Arquette. And boy, I didn't know that Grace Zabriskie was in this. So that's cool.
So I have the right game. Until Dawn was the one with the weird cryptid twist, right?
Yeah, it turns out to be Wendigos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. No. That's weird. It's been a while since since not just a quorum, but a majority of people on the show have played the same game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, throw you for a loop that I was one of them. I never play a new game.
Yeah.
Well, I say that. I actually have. But I also often buy a new game and then it sits in my backlog like that Kirby game, which I haven't really played that much of yet.
Yep. Well, you have to wait until it's a retro game.
I know. But it has to pass the particular test and it's not to that point yet.
Yeah.
It's not ready yet. It's not ripe enough.
It needs to age like wine or cheese. Yeah.
Something like
you
that.
You need to wait for it to get an HD remaster you can buy.
Yeah, exactly.
Jala, let's go to you.
Okay. So speaking about games that have to age for a while before I get to them, I got two of those to talk about. One of which is one that I played back in 2020 and I streamed it, I believe, for a duck feed event of some sort. Where the Water Tastes Like Wine.
Yeah, you've spoken of this in the past. Storytelling game. Yeah.
It is a storytelling game, and I pop back into it more or less because I got into a conversation with Jack, aka Chicken Riggies, and anyway, I just picked it up. Like, I had intended to pick it up again right after playing it, but then I just kind of wandered off because, I don't know, stuff happened, and, you know, it happens. And I had intended to play it. I've kept it downloaded for 2 years on my computer. And I only recently just pulled it back up again. So I don't know if I need to talk about this from the beginning, since it's been a minute since I played it. So to explain how this game works.
I mean, I
could use a refresher.
I'll give you a quick rundown. So, developed by Dimbulb Games and Serenity Forge, published by Good Shepherd Entertainment in 2018 for Mac and PC in 2019 for Switch, PS4, and Xbox One. The title comes from an excerpt from a traditional folk song called Going Down the Road Feeling Bad. So there's that. There's actually an achievement called Where the Water Tastes Like Wine, but literally nobody can get it. You can't get that achievement. Mm. And that's the point, is that you can't get it. So anyway, you play a traveling skeleton in Great Depression era America, where you collect and retell stories that you experience firsthand and also hear from other people that you meet along the road. So the mechanics are such that you get around by various ways. You can walk, hitchhike, and freight hop on trains. You can walk faster if you whistle along with the overworld music, which changes as you go from different regions in America. To do this, you have to hold down a control key and then follow simple directional arrow cues in a little thing in the corner, and then you walk faster. You can also only hitchhike near the highway, of course, and there are people and campsites that are farther away from the highway too, so that's not always a viable option. And you also have to have money to hop on a train, so you have to get money to use that option. And you've got 3 meters: money, hunger, and tiredness, and you can die even though you are a skeleton. You get money by working in cities and occasionally in remote areas if a farmer or somebody hires you. This adds to your tiredness meter. When you buy food, of course, you have to buy it unless somebody happens to share some of theirs with you on the road. You can't just lay down anywhere and rest just on the ground. You have to be in certain spots on the map, like under a big tree outside somewhere or at a hostel in a town or something like that. And the primary goal of the game is to meet other travelers at their campsites, which have really big markers on the map, and then to share your stories that you have collected as you've roamed around the U.S. And these travelers ask for certain types of stories, like scary or thrilling ones, and you need to select the appropriate tale to tell them. And in doing so, you get them to warm up to you and tell you more about themselves and their own story. And you complete the game by unlocking all of the full stories for each of these individuals that you find all throughout America. And when you activate a campfire, when there's a key traveler around, you're taken to a new screen where you have four rounds of storytelling to engage with. And as you successfully tell them the correct type of story, an icon at the top of the screen progressively opens. And when it fully opens, the next chapter of their story unlocks to you. Once you tell a traveler a story, that story is taken out of play, even if there are updates to the story that you hear during your travels. So you have to keep collecting more and more stories in order to progress the game. When the evening ends, the traveler tells you where they're going, and then they show you on the map where they're going to be setting up camp next, so you can roam around gathering more stories and then come back and find them. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea what happens when you've heard all of these stories, because I'm in the process of that right now, but that is the main crux of the game. So I think it just kind of wraps up at that point. The titles of the stories can be pretty deceptive though, because the names change in the telling and retelling. So any walkthrough that you try to look up has approximate titles, but can't possibly list every single permutation of the name. Some of the names sound like they might be a scary story, but they're actually a funny one, etc. too. So you actually need to pay attention to the content of each of the narratives as you come across them in the world. And that provided a challenge to me picking the game up after not playing for 2 years, which is why I know about the walkthroughs and the name changes. So I remembered details about some of the stories, but did not remember other details at all. So this is a game that necessitates fairly regular play sessions until you get what you want out of it, unless you have a walkthrough and can kind of puzzle out which one must be talking about what. And much of this game is narrated, and the voice of the narrator is so good. He's like a really low and rumbly sort of guy with a bit of a twang to his voice. And he's just, it reminds me, I guess, kind of the Bastion narration, something like that. And the soundtrack is top notch, and I listen to it regularly. It's got 30 tracks of authentic style Americana, folk, jazz, blues, country, bluegrass, a bunch of different types of things.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about this game, too, is that it suffered a complete commercial release disaster. One of the devs, or the main writer, main guy who was working on this, said, I can't discuss the exact numbers, but in the first few weeks, fewer people bought the game than I have Twitter followers, and I don't have a lot of Twitter followers. And he also said, at the end of the day, it's astounding that a game that got this much attention from the press, which is how I heard about it. I had reported about this story as a news piece long before it came out. Anyway, this much attention from the press that won awards, that had an all-star cast of writers and performers, that had a random celebrity guest appearance by Sting, it still failed. Yeah, Sting plays the wolf character.
Yeah.
So anyway, it failed this hard. So he said, basically, I'm not sure that games like this one can continue to be made in the current market. So there's not going to be another one of these made. But it's interesting. I've enjoyed the bits that I've played. Even opening it back up again, I was able to remember the basic mechanics really easily, and kind of went, oh man, this music is so good. I would not mind just kind of spacing out and playing a little of this game for a while, because it's real relaxing.
It was composed by Ryan Eich. He like weirdly is kind of in the like the Duckfeed circle, kinda. Composer, he did the music for West of Loathing, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. He's a prolific composer, but just it was like weird to see his name pop up when I did a search on this because like, oh yeah, him, he rules.
Yeah. So any questions about Where the Water Tastes Like Wine?
Can you assemble the stories wrong as you find them, or is it a matter of remembering which ones are the matches?
You basically just like, it's not that you're assembling the stories. As you walk around and you hear different iterations of the story itself changes over time. And so the title will change over time. Mm. So something that used to be called the Thunderbirds would be like the birds from the other dimension or something, depending upon right. what type of spin people are saying about these critters or whatever, you know, so it changes over time as new information is added. So you have to pay attention to all of those little bits as they pop up, because that's going to alter the title. So when you're going to look for this, when you're at a campsite trying to talk to a key traveler, you know, it'll change the name and it might not be exactly the same as what you remembered it originally.
Yeah. So when I took a class on urban legends in college, that was actually the biggest thing they emphasized, is the fact that like the number one things about folk stories is the fact that they change.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool.
Yeah. And this really, even though I wasn't obviously alive during the Great Depression or any of that stuff, it gives me like,
give it time.
Well, yeah, I know. But, like, even though that's the case, I still feel a lot of nostalgia playing this game just because it's real familiar Americana stuff. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's been fun to play.
Nice.
Any other questions about that one, or can I talk about the other one?
I think you can talk to the other one.
Okay. The other one is To the Moon.
Yeah, you're not happy with this.
No, I'm not. I'm still not happy with this. I played it really briefly in 2015 and bounced off it real hard.
Right.
And I said I was going to try it again later. Mm-hmm. I talked about it, and it wasn't ever like, if you try to search it on the Level podcast, you won't find it, because I didn't talk about it as like one of my entries that week. I just happened to mention.
This was around the time you played A Bird Story, right? You were like, I really like this. I think that I might like this developer. Let's play the big one that they did.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been 7 years since the last time I played this game and I completed half of it. And I actually don't know if I'm ever going to finish it. And I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about why and everything else. So, okay. This is a psychological drama adventure game by Freebird Games, who made A Bird Story, which I love. And To the Moon was released in 2011. It's real old. Anyway, it was written by Kangao with the music by Kangao and Laura Shigihara. And I know a lot of people seem to adore Laura's work.
Yeah.
So there's that. The music is the score on this is very good.
Yeah.
So, and that the music told so much of the story and did some real heavy lifting in A Bird Story, because that one doesn't have any text. It's wordless, but to its advantage, I feel. So anyway, in this game, a company has created technology to implant artificial memories into somebody's brain. Because this conflicts with the person's actual memories, it's only legal to do so on comatose patients who don't have very much life left in them. A man named Johnny has contracted their services and he's on his deathbed. You play as a pair of absolutely terrible doctors or engineers or whatever they are, and they have atrocious bedside manner and a marked lack of empathy, and whose back and forth banter just seems to pad the game and absolutely just irritate the crap out of me. And I don't know if that's because I more or less live in a rest home taking care of my elderly parents that I just can't stand these two.
Yeah.
But anyway, I guess it's supposed to be funny. It's not to my taste if it is.
It's like if you were playing a game where the main characters were Kirsten Dunst and Mark Ruffalo's characters from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but doing the opposite of what they're doing in that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So also another thing to mention is that Johnny's wife, River, has some kind of neurodiverse situation. And according to Wikipedia, it's implied to be Asperger's syndrome, but literally nobody in the game talks about it directly, which is really weird and not like anyone I have ever met with a diverse neurology whatsoever. Yeah. I have a close family member with Asperger's. And so this treatment of it makes it feel like River's kind of an outcast. It's kind of like how in a lot of DEI materials I have been reading for that episode that I did on Jolichon's Place, white folks who mistakenly believe themselves to be quote unquote not racist will use coded language to talk about race in negative ways. And it kind of feels like that the way that it's presented, at least so far in the half of the game I played with her situation. So that was kind of another turnoff for me. But in either case, what you're doing in the game is you're diving into Johnny's memories and working your way backward from old age to childhood to reroute his memories and grant his dying wish, which was to go to the moon. So you watch a memory play out, and then you wander around the scene randomly clicking on stuff to see if you get a little memory crystal to pop up. And then you jump via a memento backward to an older memory where the same memento also exists. And at first, you have no idea what would be a memento existing across different memories, and it's not telegraphed per se, so it can be really irritating to try to figure out what the key item is. And once you initiate that jump, you also have to solve this arbitrary tile flip puzzle that is not additive to the game experience, and I don't know why that's there. And then also, there's no telegraphing of what in the scene generates memory crystals, so you just end up clicking on everything, which is just time-wasting and irritating. So a lot of the mechanical stuff just isn't, you know, even if the premise sounds really interesting, it sounds like something that I dig, and even if the soundtrack is really good, the actual execution of a lot of the dialogue stuff, and then just the mechanics of the game just aren't doing it for me.
Yeah.
And I've played,
forward.
Yeah. And I think part of it is that I've played other games that have done similar concepts of an old man looking back on his life or trying to fulfill a final dream or whatever, which have been more gracefully executed, such as Old Man's Journey most recently. Now, granted, this is an 11-year-old game at this point, and the ones that I feel have done it better are more modern. But still, the bottom line is that I still feel like I'm left wanting halfway through. So I don't know if it's worth it to me to finish the game. I mean, it, pretty much everybody who has talked to me about it is like, oh, by the, you know, I understand what you mean. But by the end of it, I really liked all the characters. Well, that's another hour and a half or 2 hours away. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I like this game. At least I did when I played it. That admittedly, that was 10 years ago. So, yeah. So it's hard to, you know, it's hard to say, if I would still have the patience for it. And obviously time compresses bullshit to some degree, you know, you just kind of remember the high points. The high points are very good to me. Though I recognize all the stuff you're saying as true, you know. I don't know how I would feel about it today. All of that is to say, I could not, as somebody who has good memories of this game, decide whether or not it is worth your time to go through and see the end of it. Like, that's for you.
Well, and also you have been in the situation where you think, yes, you should go ahead and do this thing. You did it once. You don't ever want to do it again.
No. Yeah. So I just, as somebody who has like praised this game in the past, I think that I, you know, not that you need my license to cut bait, but like, if you're not having a good time, you're not having a good time. Like, you can read the synopsis and see whether it would have been, you know, worth it to you.
Yeah, I have not done so far as to read a synopsis, because I'm still kind of on the fence about, I don't know if I really want to go back and try to finish it, or, you know, if all of this, because then too, I don't know if the people who are talking to me about this game also played it so long ago that they don't necessarily remember everything so much as like me, old woman playing in 2022, looking at this game is going to, you know, feel different about it than me 12 years ago or whatever, play, you know, 11 years ago playing this game when it was new, like that would have been a very different experience had I played it 11 years ago.
Yeah.
So
I just, I remember some stuff that seemed kind of, was actually like a misdirect, you know, things ended up being recontextualized, but like, I don't know, like if the misdirect feels bad, it still feels bad.
Well, and two, if it's been a decade since then, like, you know, memory is a very weird thing. So I don't know. I will continue to debate about this. I probably, given the fact that I'm going to be going out of town, I most likely am not going to be playing this anytime soon, at least not this week. So if people listening to this have feelings about To the Moon and any recent memories about it, please feel free to discuss it with me and give me your POV.
Yeah. Also, if something came out while I was podcasting, it cannot be called very old. kind of like
it's very old, Cole.
Kind of.
I also call myself old. Okay, so
yeah, I'm actually not anxious about getting old. It's just to me, it is more. Oh, yeah. It is more about just like, oh, time can't be moving that quick. It's kind of like when they announced a remake of Diamond and Pearl. It's like, why would they remake that? That came out when I was in college. You know, it's just, yeah.
I'm not concerned by like something happening 11 years ago, but it's like the things that you thought happened, you know, like a few months ago. It's like, oh no, that was 2 years ago.
Oh yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No,
I know. Like, I actually thought that I had played like Where the Water Tastes Like Wine in 2019. So I actually projected it further back. I've turned the corner and I start overestimating how long away that was.
Well, then you're never disappointed.
Yeah, exactly.
I like Facebook Memories is terrible about this, and it's terrible in a lot of ways, but like it just like it showed me a picture of Dottie and Greta, you know, because that's pretty much all the photos I take anyway, but also the only photos I share. But it was like, oh, here's this. And I was like, oh yeah, that was like a month ago when I did that. No, it was a year. So,
yeah. I mean, to be fair, we did just lose 2 years.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. I'm sorry. This is a bummer for you.
Yeah. Like it's not like a total bummer. I can separate myself away from this one easier than I can from, you know, the Until Dawn and et cetera games.
Yeah.
So like that one actually takes some active work on my part because that's, you know, an immediate directly to me type of thing. So that's pretty much the only other thing I have to say about that. So it's not out of the realm of possibility for me to finish the game and even to really like it. It's just that I just don't know if the payoff is going to be worth the emotional toil to get to that payoff. I suppose what'll happen is that I will play The Quarry this week and see how that goes. And if it works well, great. Then I might be able to go and play To the Moon. But if it doesn't, then maybe I don't play To the Moon either because I am misjudging my success rate here.
Yeah, I don't see a reason to unnecessarily tax your patience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all. That's what I've been playing.
Cool. Well, that sounds like a segment to me.
Yay!
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where usually we ask you a question and then you answer. But Jala, thank you very, very much for posting this this week. We're doing a free play. This is a free play day. Where you ask us questions and then we answer it. How do you like it now? The table's turning.
Yay.
Yeah. It had been a while since you'd been on a free play, Jala. So this works out. I'll get us started. I will proctor this. Callum says, what is the best Kickstarter, not your own, that you have backed? You know,
I've never backed a Kickstarter.
I can tell you, Reading Rainbow.
Oh, easy. Yeah. That makes sense.
I think I've only backed one thing, so I have an easy answer, and I think it's Deck of Wonders. So. Oh,
yeah, yeah. Let's say Deck of Wonders. I haven't played the game yet, but I assume it's going to be good. I trust Dennis.
It's easier for me. If you've only backed one thing, it has to be the best thing you've backed.
Yeah, yeah. And I've backed a you know a handful of things, but like nothing that sticks out is like, oh yeah, this was a thing that I backed on Kickstarter, and this is like a personal Kickstarter success story. So I will abstain.
Have any of you guys had particularly bad failures with Kickstarter?
Oh yeah, stuff not being made and things like that. Like I used to back stuff a lot more years ago, really when Kickstarter had its gigantic craze, and I was just like, I want to help support people making things because I would love for someone to support me making things. And I was trying to pay it forward, and then it was like, except they didn't make the things. And, you know, like I still tried to help them, but it's sad when you get to see the business go under or whatever. Yeah. You know, that's sad stuff.
I don't think I've ever
of y'all supported like Star Citizen or anything.
No, God, no. No.
No.
Oh.
Yeah. No, nothing. I don't think I've ever backed anything that didn't come to fruition, but I kept my powder dry on it. So I, you know, like it, I had to be pretty sure about if I was going to back something because I just didn't like the idea of anything being just a glorified pre-order, you know? So, yeah. Greg asks, what new game or project announced this year or confirmed are you most excited about and why? It's especially relevant to talk about it now, because of stuff that's in the news, all these events and stuff. I mean, everything that I am most excited for is stuff that I've been like looking forward to that has just gotten like a release date. So like Gloomwood is hitting early access in August. Scorn was announced, to have an October release in, during the Microsoft Games show kind of deal. So that's my version of this is, and maybe that's just because I try not to be terribly excited about stuff until it feels imminent, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's for me. How about you, Joel?
Every time someone asks the same question, my answer is always consistently, I don't really pay attention to new release information. However, people have informed me forcibly that Resident Evil 4, Resident Evil 8 DLC, and also the new Pokemon game. So of those, the one I'm actually most interested in is the Pokemon game because I got so much mileage out of Sword playing with Dave, John, and Desiree.
Uh-huh.
And so that'll be like our chill and hang out in the middle of the week when we are fried and dead and don't really want to do stuff type of game to play together. So that's probably the one that will get the most mileage. I also will play the Resident Evil stuff, of course, but like I consistently don't really get excited about anything. Even when I'm excited about stuff, I'm always skeptical. So whatever, I don't know.
that's also the case. Like, I mean, I can get excited about it, but realistically, I'm not going to be playing it for a few months anyway. Even if ever.
And for me, like, it's always a wild card whether or not I'm going to buy it when it first comes out. And even if I buy it, who's to say if I'm actually going to play it right away? Like, I got on Resident Evil 8 pretty quick, but like I still have Kirby and I haven't played that one yet, and it's just sitting there, and I played some of Shin Megami Tensei 5 and I stopped, so I mean like I don't know. But then I bought The Quarry. Who ever thought I'd buy that? I don't know.
Yeah. Shrug. What are you looking forward to, Ben?
I think the Harry Potter RPG game looks sweet. I think that comes up sometime this year, maybe it's next year, I can't remember.
Yeah,
but if that's this year, then that.
Okay. David, how about you?
I don't know anything that's coming out this year.
It's weird. It's been a weird few years for game release stuff, for everything release stuff, but yeah.
I guess Elden Ring did come out this year. So.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although I was super disappointed with it, so.
Were you? Oh, I didn't. Yeah. Didn't know that. We could talk about that.
We're out of the grind, so we can't talk about that.
Let's see here. Jeff writes, Xbox and Bethesda just announced a crazy amount of new games on their Xbox Game Pass service coming in the next month. Is it safe to say that Xbox has totally won the subscription war for the next year or two? Oh, absolutely. Because they tried. Yeah. No, I mean, the fact that it's on PC, like pretty much, like if it's not complete parity, it is mostly complete parity between the two of them. Oh, God. Yeah. No, just without question.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand Sony's current business model of let's be evil. Like, I'm only kind of joking. Like, it just seems like they consistently choose whatever option will piss people off the most.
Yeah. No, it's it's the PlayStation Plus, the weird stuff that they're doing with that. They shot themselves in the foot by having those multiple tiers. Xbox Game Pass is simple, you know, it's easy. Anyway.
Well, and like, I could even understand it if the tiers were like, you know, pro-consumer. You know, if I don't know, if the lowest tier was, you know, somewhat equivalent to Game Pass, and the highest tier was just like, I don't know, any game ever, you know, or yeah. Whatever.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, I saw a funny tweet when Microsoft, they announced, yeah, we're bringing Persona 3, 4, and 5 to Game Pass over the course of this year. And somebody tweeted, like, it's really weird how Xbox has a better PSP library on their system than PlayStation does. Because Sony didn't include Persona stuff in it. Even though, that's like, funny. Persona 4 is, you know, kind of one of the most loved games for the PSP or PS Vita rather. Yeah, bummer. Let's see. John writes, what is your favorite video game OST? This is, I have multiple different answers to this question. I'll say all-timer Machinarium for me. And just one that I have been getting a lot of listens to out of recently is Disco Elysium. Soundtrack.
Yeah, I'm going to evaluate it as, like, the most cohesive, like, overall good one instead of, like, which one has, like, the highest highs. I'll say FTL.
FTL's is a very good soundtrack. Now, David, how about you?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd have to go with Halo. Oh, no, that's ODST.
Halo does have the best ODST.
Yes. I'll be honest, I'm not sure I have one, which is why I made that dumb joke.
Okay, no, you're just trying to distract us.
I wanted to feel like I wasn't completely slacking off on the answer.
No, it's you can just not value game music, and that's fine. And Jala, how about you?
So, most recently, Where the Water Tastes Like Wine, but kind of overall, the ones that have been in my workout playlist and played most frequently over the last, two, 3 years, have been the Danganronpa soundtrack, the Persona 4 soundtrack, which is funny because I had issues with both of those games playing them, but the music's really good.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I ended up landing on the side of liking them, but, you know.
Yeah,
anyway,
it wasn't without its hassles.
Yeah. And then Lone Wolf Remastered, that one.
Okay, yeah.
So actually, if I could get a soundtrack that's just all the theme songs from the Kingdom Hearts series, that'd be a pretty solid one.
Okay. I don't know what Kingdom Hearts music sounds like, so.
It is not indicative of the music as the whole, but each of the games has one like lead song for it that's generally really strong.
It's like do they do the standard anime vocal ballad kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Christopher writes, what is the best vegetable?
You did not say it with the proper inflection, sir.
What's the best vegetable?
Wait, there what? You go. Well, there's a lot of question marks and exclamation points on that.
Yeah.
I feel like this is another tough question like the OST, because it's like it depends on how you evaluate it.
Like, no, yes. I feel like this is like, what is the best vegetable and why is it avocado?
Avocado is a fruit, my friend.
Uh-huh. False.
Yeah.
False.
It's a, I mean, it's a savory fruit. Oh, let's get down into this. Yeah, tomatoes are fruits as well. Mind blown.
Well, according to the cube theory of fruits.
Yeah. No, I hate when people do that, but I get annoyed when I go to buy peppers and they're listed, mm-hmm. Like, you know, you've got to, weigh them and you pick the, you have to, you know, pick like, okay, I'm weighing peppers now, price it as peppers. And they're always listed under vegetables. And I'm like, you monsters, you fools.
I know. I was like, oh, peppers aren't. Okay.
Yeah.
Dang
yeah.
it. No.
The horticultural definition of a vegetable is different than the dietary definition of a vegetable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like if we are counting peppers, then peppers obviously would be mm-hmm. would be there. Like for me personally, like I would cut out like root vegetables just because like man onions. Which is the for some reason those feel more like staples to me, like onions and potatoes.
I was gonna say if we're going with botanical definition, definitely potatoes. I mean, that's kind of they're probably single-handedly responsible for Europe not starving to death.
Yeah, because they can grow anywhere, and it's one of the only botanical foods that you could just eat and live off of. Not well, but yeah.
By the way, I just harvested a whole bunch of potatoes from my garden. I'm eating them this week.
Ooh. Yeah,
I put pictures on the internet. I will share to the backstage for you.
And you can grow like anything down in Houston, right?
Not anything, but a lot of things. Yes.
Yeah.
The only good thing I could find that grew here that I like is what is it? Tomatillos or whatever.
Tomatillos. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm gonna, you know, I know they're trendy or whatever, but I really enjoy them, and it's like a vegetable I can always cook in a reliable way, and it tastes great and goes well with everything. Brussels sprouts, man. Brussels sprouts are good.
Brussels sprouts are really good. I would say broccoli. It has protein in it, and it's pretty substantive for a green veggie.
Yeah. Broccoli with cheese is amazing.
Cheese is not a vegetable.
Yes. are we including leafy greens too? Because like that's a vegetable, but by volume, I probably eat more spinach than any other vegetable. But
spinach is good. I like kale quite a bit too.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm gonna say Brussels sprouts. Continue.
I feel like when it gets to like greens though, like collard greens and dandelion greens, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It really bothers me. I feel like those are all the same thing. Like,
I mean,
they're all bitter. Yes. I mean, like
I feel like that is the David equivalent of like the people who like sneer at wine experts. They're like, nah, they can't really taste.
Difference. I mean, you're closer than you think because, botanically all of them are just brassica. So like bok choy, cauliflower, broccoli, cabbage, choy soon, kohlrabi, napa cabbage, rutabaga, turnip, mustard plants, Brussels sprouts are basically like they're all just different like varietals of the same plant. So
really?
yeah, that's like a lot of them are just different ways to grow brassica something or other. Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
Today I learned.
Yep.
A lot of those were in my garden.
Yeah.
And soon they will be in your belly.
Well, yeah. No, like it's already way too hot. So like those are long out of the garden at this point.
No, those are
only the peppers survive.
Yeah. Those would be scorched under the sun, most likely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ben, favorite veggie.
Also Brussels sprouts. You swoop my answer, but we'll just have to be united.
It's a no. I mean, it's perfect. You just
we can share the veggies.
Yeah, that's so simple. I just man, the disservice that I got growing up where I did and when I did, when every fucking vegetable was boiled out of a fucking can.
Nobody knew to bake them. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, just roast them. That's where flavor happens.
I air fry potatoes, like little fingerling potatoes and Brussels sprouts, sprayed with a little bit of like light maple syrup, and then I put fresh rosemary on it. It's mm-hmm. so good. You can also put it in the oven that way. Very good.
Take those like the little potatoes you can get, mm-hmm. you know, fingerlings are like the more round ones, parboil them, you know, so they're a little bit soft. Put them on some parchment paper on a baking tray, take a cup and kind of smash them, or take some forks and kind of smash them down, drizzle them with olive oil, and put salt and pepper on them. Put them in the put them in the oven to roast them. That is a delicious way to make just nice little like crunch on the outside, fluffy in the inside, smashed potato kind of things. Delicious. Anyway, Patrick writes.
We're circling back to the hunger from the banter.
Yes. Yeah. I swear. I had dinner. I'm not hungry. But I guess I am. Patrick writes. What is a game that is generally considered bad by most, but is your guilty pleasure? I have a tormented relationship with Silent Hill 4, but yeah, I would say, yeah, that's that is one where people say, yeah, it's Silent Hill well past its sell-by date. But also it is too full of cool ideas for me to completely write it off.
Friday the
13th. Yeah. For my answer.
Tracks.
Yeah. Jala.
Guilty pleasure insinuates that I give a damn what anybody else thinks about it.
That's the thing. You just kind of, you kind of have to assume.
If we're just talking about just nominally, lots of people say that it's bad, but you like it anyway and could care less what anybody else thinks. Then I would have to say, I guess RE6 because I like it.
That's a really good answer. Like it's kind of the answer to every question for a few of us, but it is also a really good answer for this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. RE6 is a good answer. I kind of want to be snarky and say Destiny.
David, doesn't it have to be the Stanley Parable for you?
Oh, well, that's true. That's true. Anyways, I'm not even going into that. Also Army of Two.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
Huh. I have nothing to add to that. Let's see here. David, asks, every country or culture has their own version of dumplings. That is a dough wrapper of some kind enveloping meat and or other ingredients. What is your favorite?
Point of order, cube theory of food, technically calzones.
Okay. Okay. for me, just because of where I grew up, we get a lot of pierogi here, but samosa. I am fond of a samosa or an empanada.
Samosas are very good, and I grew up on empanadas and croquetas, so I'm kind of partial to those. But then I also just had gyoza this evening.
God,
so
gyoza are so
know.
Fucking good. Oh God. Man, my
samosas were the Girl Scout cookies.
Samoas.
Yeah. Samosas are Indian food. There's potato or peas inside. Yeah. Man, gyoza. I had a man, my half sister has a her boyfriend has a is half Japanese. His grandma makes amazing gyoza. I had them once just because they were at a graduation party for her, and I still think about them.
They are fabulous. And we actually made some homemade gyoza. I don't know, it must have been about half a year ago at this point, but it was pretty funny because, you know, like I was chopping all the ingredients and then Dave was in charge of crimping all the little wrappers. We had 50 bajillion wrappers and he was dutifully crimping all of them. He's like, my hands still hurt. These hands could never make gyoza again. So props to grandmother for doing all of that hard work.
Yeah, it was not for an entire party. This was like a private stash.
Yeah.
What are you
putting
this
wasn't for an entire party for me and Dave either. Yeah. This was just for, like, literally us.
It's so. it's a very labor intensive food. What do you put in yours if you don't do pork?
We put Beyond Meat, or we put tofu, and we can also do any number of other mixtures with edamame, etc. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Nice.
So I think for me on this one, Matt Marcus has the right idea. Wei said, Zhao Long Bao, have dim sum, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
I was also going to pull the Air Bud argument and be like, yeah, dumplings are the best one.
Specifically the dim sum you could get at a Chinese street food kind of place, or do
back when I was in Chinatown. Although I think the ones he's talking about is specifically like the steamed ones, which are amazing, but I was very partial to the ones made with glutinous rice flour and coated in sesame seeds because it's chewy.
Yeah. No.
Glutinous rice flour with sesame seeds. That's daifuku, sounds like.
Yeah. What?
Daifuku. That's a Japanese dessert, actually, most of the time. Hmm.
How do you spell that?
D-A-I-F-U-K-U. Daifuku.
Okay. This is... Now you know what I'm going to be eating tomorrow.
Yeah. I love daifuku. That's like one of my favorite treats.
Guys, I think I might actually be hungry.
I have not had dinner tonight, so I'm ready.
I have discovered that I like lots of versions of dumpling-like things. Huh? Thank you, David, for elucidating
me. So is mochi technically a dumpling? Ice cream dumpling?
Not, if it's meat-flavored ice cream, I guess, for this question.
Enveloping meat and or other ingredients. It could be something else. It could be a sweet dumpling.
Yeah, lotus dumplings are great.
Yeah, it's a sweet dumpling. Yes.
Huh.
It qualifies.
And finally here, Jeremy writes, do you have any habit related to video games? Any game game habits? I take notes on them because I talk about them on podcasts.
I definitely have one because I'm still playing Fire Emblem Heroes. And so I have a habit of logging in every day for my little freebie rewards and playing until I run out of my little energies or whatever, and then turning it off at some point. Like, I'm not as hyper into it as I was for, 3 or 4 months or however long it was, but I'm still playing.
Hmm. Yeah. So just a daily practice. Mm-hmm. Ben, how about you?
I think the only habit is talking about them every week when we record.
Yeah.
I'm a big wiki person, I guess would probably be my habit.
Do you just read wikis of games you haven't played or only played a little bit?
Yes. And then if I do play a game, it's, definitely I look up all the strategies and stuff like that. Like, I'm a min-maxer, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
Oh, no. Then that means that the end boss that I have is detrimental to your life. We'll talk about it.
This happens.
Well, since you talked about the end boss, I think we should wrap this up. Thanks, everybody, for writing your questions. If you if you want to participate in these in the future, go to facebook.com/thelevelpodcast and watch for the prompts to go up on Monday afternoons. Thank you, Jolla, for posting this.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are going on in the world of video games that are either exciting to us or interesting in some way. Jolla, what are those fuckers at Blizzard doing?
Those fuckers at Blizzard made Diablo Immortal. It's a new free-to-play mobile game, and it showcases basically every worst aspect of the freemium model possible. So YouTubers Matt and Michael of Bellular News calculated how much it would cost to max out a character, and it totals a whopping $110,000 of real-ass money for this free-to-play game to max your character out. So there's 3 progression pillars alongside regular gear and XP, and they dictate endgame tier progress beyond the level cap. As of right now, free-to-play players cannot earn top rated legendary gems, which are only available through monetization options. And those gems are not even guaranteed drops for paying players, as they're only randomly awarded upon purchasing loot boxes. So with the game's current iteration, it would take a free-to-play player 10 years to fully kit out a character, playing it as much as possible.
Woof.
So this game has been highly praised for being true to Diablo's gameplay, however. And if you are not David Money Smith, and you are not interested in min-maxing, it might still be fun to play as long as you can control your impulse urge to buy loot boxes if you have such an urge. Also, Warcraft Mobile is on the way, so expect more of this type of release in the future.
I would think,
personally, I think being David Mysmith is the ideal way to play a game.
Well, you don't know any different. I would think Blizzard, for all of the, you know, for all of the bad stink that is on their name, would really want to avoid this. But
yeah, remember when I was talking about business strategies that look like let's just be evil?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't care for it one bit. But also, they're not just making money from it here in America. They don't, you know, care too much. You know, they really don't care about their reputation, it seems. So let them be crapulent. No, don't let them be crapulent. I'm just, yeah, hate it.
I mean, if they're advertising their game to people who have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, then I don't know if those people feel a lot of remorse from buying a game from whatever company. I don't know.
It's all Whale Hunt. Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. It's weird.
Yeah. I got one. This was just yesterday. Capcom did their yearly kind of big E3-ish, but not E3 announcement. There was a little bit more Resident Evil 4 remake footage that was shown. The thing that is most interesting to me is last year they had announced that they were going to have DLC, like an expansion for Resident Evil 8 Village. I'm going to split the difference on that. Resident Evil 8 Village, they announced that they were working on that, and I was wondering, whatever happened to that? What happened to it is they just announced it today. It is coming out on October the 28th. It is called Winter's Expansion Pack, is what it is. There is going to be a story DLC called Shadows of Rose, following a relative of Ethan Winters. That is as specific as I'm going to be, which seems pretty cool. They were obviously kind of hinting at something happening with this in the main story, and the footage of it looks pretty creepy and good to me. Looks like it's leaning into stuff that is cool about Resident Evil Village. Additionally, they are adding a Mercenaries mode, which I think will be real cool. Mercenaries mode is the you know, action-based, run-based, you know, score attack kind of deal. They didn't have one of those. They didn't have a mercenary mode in RE7. It was dearly missed, and I think that it is going to be a welcome addition. You can even play as Lady Dimitrescu. So I don't know if that's like playing as Jaws in GoldenEye, where it was a disadvantage because he's so big. But they did feature that. The other thing about this is that they are adding a third person mode, which is real weird, given how great the lengths are, how many great lengths they went to hide Ethan's face. Now you just get to see him. So that'll be interesting. But yeah, they're adding a third person mode, making this feel a little bit more like the, you know, RE2 and RE3 remake. All that looks pretty cool. I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sold on Rose as a character, so
yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that. We'll see. Yeah. I'm gonna play it either way.
That's the thing. So it's hard to be. It's a fait accompli. Like I'm going.
Yeah, it's real hard for me to be super worked up one way or the other because I know I'm going to just play it. So
yeah. Any other comments about this before we move on to the next one?
No.
David, who's missing the point?
Yeah, Netflix. Netflix is the one missing the point. They have announced that they are making a Squid Games reality TV show that's going to basically recreate the game in the show, which is weird because the most important part of the game in the show is the part where people die.
Oh, so many people die. All but one.
Yeah, so, yeah, one, just like, if you're going to do a thing, don't half-ass it.
No half measures, Walter.
But also, you know, kind of the whole point of Squid Games is anti-capitalism, and there are a few things in life more capitalism than reality TV.
Yeah.
They're not the first to do this, though. There have been a couple of YouTubers who have done, like, bigger productions, like emulating Squid Game.
Yeah, I know, and...
they haven't murdered anyone, though.
Yeah, still exploitative. I'm also a little bit weird about them bringing it back for a second season, you know? Because just, I don't know, making it into a franchise also seems to miss the point. I also was, like, fine with the way Squid Game... like, I liked that show very well. I thought it was, you know, good enough. So, just Netflix as a company. No, sorry, guys. You done fell off. You done fell off. And Ben, what's happening in space?
Yeah, so there's a Bethesda, like, announcement this last week, or they did a show where they released a bunch of announcements. They showed a gameplay trailer of Starfield, which I hadn't really followed too closely before this, but it's basically like Space Skyrim is what a lot of people are calling it. But the demo of it showed you, like, kind of going around a planet, fighting these people. It showed the level up system. And they started to show some really cool features of it where you can design your own ship that you're going from your base to other parts of the galaxy in. But it's a very, like, very open-ended, like, ship construction sort of thing. Like, but whatever you design, like, in this, you know, blueprints thing or whatever, you can actually, like, it'll take off and fly and you can fight with it. So that part looked really sweet. Mm-hmm. And then the announcement kind of ended with a thud where they're like, and how big is this world? Well, here's the solar system and you can go to any part of the planet. It's like, oh, that doesn't sound good. It's like, there's, you know, like 10 planets in this solar system. And then there's like, you can go to 1,000 planets in the entire game because there's this many solar systems. Like, oh shit, this game's gonna suck. And so,
you know how this goes, guys. Like, why are you stepping on that same rake? Like, a handful of different people already stepped on that rake for you. No.
So they're basically, and so I'll try and withhold judgment, but they're basically making all the same promises that No Man's Sky did when they were launching.
Yeah. But I mean, Bethesda is the type of company to then do 6 years of free expansions to make up for it, right?
Yeah, that sounds like them. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, best case scenario could be like another Skyrim game where there's a whole bunch of content there and it's really awesome. But worst case scenario, it could be a very boring universe. So,
or it could be like Skyrim where there's a lot of content and it's all the freaking same.
When you get to the infinite quest part. Yeah.
I really debated my number two. My number two story was they're saying they're making the next Fallout game after the next Elder Scrolls game. So, you know, we're never getting another Fallout game.
Oh, man, they can't juggle three things. Something's got to give. Cool. Well, this has been a bit of a long one. How do you all feel about buttoning it up?
I feel buttons.
Let's button.
The credit.
Thank you so much for listening to level number 418. We really appreciate you taking the time, and we hope you come back next week. You know how to help this show, what with Patreon and what with social media and telling folks and participating in the multiplayer at facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. No other admin stuff on our side, unless I'm forgetting something.
Nope.
Jala, what's going on at Jala's place?
So, Jala Chen's place, last week we had the episode of The Batman, the movie that came out this year. So you can check that out. And also coming up, let's see, the 24th is going to be an episode about performance and identity, and also relating to gender identity stuff. So if you are interested in the topical episode, that one will be out in a couple of weeks. So,
yeah.
Actually, let's see, that would be next week when this one releases. So yes, next week.
Nice. And that is at jalachan.place.
Yes.
Yeah. Anybody else have anything?
Nope.
All right. I've been Cole Ross. You can find me on Twitter at Cole Ross.
I'm David Mysmith. You can find me.
I am Jalachan in all the places that I may be found, including Jalachan.place.
I've been Ben Merkel.
And stick around for some titles. I don't have any other. It's not a title rich environment.
I have one title.
Okay.
And that is cheese is not a vegetable, David.
Yeah, I thought about writing that one down, but I did not. So
I also have one. I have they're going to die, but at what cost?
Okay. I think that cheese is not a vegetable, David gets it.
Sweet.
Is everybody okay with that?
Sure. Sounds good.
Cool. All right. It is so decided.